Hello, and welcome to D-Listers of History Sidebar. In these episodes, we take a look at current events and explore their historical context. My name is Fega, and I'm a public historian and tour guide. Are you tired of election coverage yet? The 2024 election is shaping up to be historic in various ways. In this rematch of the 2020 election, we are choosing between two of the oldest major presidential candidates in U.S. history. Joe Biden is 81, and Donald Trump is 77. No matter how this election pans out, our president will be among the oldest in U.S. history. With the average life expectancy of American men currently sitting at about 77 years, I don't think people's questions about both candidates' mental and physical fitness are unreasonable. The obvious question is, who is in the vice presidency, and therefore in position to take over should the president pass away? What people are more concerned about, though, is the mental fitness of the candidates. With all this flying around my social media, I'm reminded of another moment in U.S. history when the president's mental fitness for office was questioned. In October of 1919, President Woodrow Wilson suffered a stroke that left him unable to complete the requirements of the job fully. But this didn't play out the way you might expect. You could come with me. You could come. As World War I drew to a close, many politicians, Wilson included, tried to make sense of the horrible loss of life and suffering by promising that this would be a, quote, war to end all wars. In an attempt to fulfill that promise, Wilson spent 6 months in Europe, the longest a sitting president has ever been out of the country, to negotiate the Treaty of Versailles, which included the establishment of the League of Nations. The League of Nations was the precursor to the modern UN. However, Wilson's signature on the treaty didn't mean anything until the Senate ratified it. Unfortunately, the Senate failed to do so due to concerns over America's sovereignty. The United States was entering what became an isolationist period, so the idea that it might get dragged into yet another European conflict was unappealing to some senators. Wilson believed in the Treaty of Versailles, though, and in a last-ditch effort, he took his argument directly to the American people on a brutal whistle-stop tour of the country. His already poor health suffered until he collapsed from exhaustion in Colorado. A few days after his return to the White House, First Lady Edith Wilson rushed the president's doctor to their private quarters. Wilson had collapsed and this time suffered a stroke, leaving him paralyzed on the entire left-hand side of his body. If this were to happen today, the vice president would take over if they hadn't already. Even when presidents undergo relatively minor medical procedures, they pass power off to the vice president in an official manner. In 1919, though, Edith Wilson and the president's doctors decided to hide his condition from nearly everyone, including other members of government. Even Secretary of State Robert Lansing was kept in the dark, though he quickly figured out that something was wrong. At the direction of Wilson's doctors, Edith Wilson assumed the role of, shall we say, like a presidential filter. She read every single piece of paper sent to the president and determined whether or not it was worthy of the sick president's attention. In her memoirs, she called this time her, quote, stewardship, and claimed that she was merely a conduit, not making any judgment calls on behalf of the president. However, she did decide what the president would and would not see, which is a massively powerful position to be in. Furthermore, she took notes and gave them to the cabinet to act on, claiming that these notes were verbatim what the president had said to her, but there is literally no way of verifying that. Secretary Lansing decided he was done with this charade, and if the president couldn't even attend cabinet meetings, he was unfit for office. This infuriated Edith, who pushed for Lansing's removal. After Lansing held a cabinet meeting without informing the president, Wilson requested and got Lansing's resignation. Vice President Thomas Marshall refused to act for fear of causing another civil war. The president did improve over this time and eventually, with Edith's assistance, could withstand short meetings with government officials sent to assess his health. Edith continued to hold a large amount of sway, though, going as far as to refuse to press the president to accept a compromise on the League of Nations from the Senate that might have allowed it to go forward. Without this compromise, the United States did not join the League of Nations, gutting it of much of its power. This, among other factors, was part of why the organization failed to prevent another world war. For the rest of her life, Edith stood in for her husband at notable political moments, including President Franklin Delano Roosevelt's request to declare war on Japan in 1941. Some claim that the frustration with her actions had more to do with their disapproval of Edith and Woodrow Wilson's marriage. This seems silly to me, though. With the benefit of a historical view, it's clear Edith Wilson and the very few people who knew of Wilson's actual condition acted extra-constitutionally. Whatever one might think of the choices made by the men who wrote and ratified our Constitution, they put checks and balances in place to prevent this sort of situation. Even if she did not impact events on her own accord, the entire setup was wildly inappropriate. Where does that leave us today, though? Outside of the constant back and forth about the mental fitness of our aging presidential candidates, Edith Wilson shows us one possible outcome of a mentally unfit president. While it seems highly unlikely that our 24-hour news cycle would miss a president having a stroke, it is reasonable to think that a possibility exists that people around a president slowly losing his mental acuity could hide it from the public and other members of government for some time. The 2024 presidential matchup is what it is. And given the damage caused by the last Trump presidency, any action outside of voting for Biden, whatever your feelings on him, seems illogical to me. At the same time, we are doing no one any favors by pretending that concerns over his ability to perform the job are ludicrous. In my humble opinion, what is needed now is a reminder of Biden's strengths and ability to adjust to the times despite his advanced years. I also think it would not be remiss for the Democratic Party to be open and honest about the guardrails around the president to keep the country going should he be no longer able to discharge his duties. Use the words like monkey bars, climb up onto the R's and the B's, and when you reach the top, release. Thank you for listening to Delicious of History. If you enjoyed yourself, please drop a review and subscribe on whatever platform you listen on. Our next episode will be coming out Monday, April 1st. It will be a biography episode, and Mazal and I will chat about the novelist Baroness Orczy and what her hero, the Scarlet Pimpernel, has to do with Batman and Iron Man and, I don't know, the general Marvel cinematic universe. Right after I stopped recording this, Mazal reminded me that Batman is, in fact, not part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. He is a DC superhero. But the point is, superheroes. We're talking about superheroes. I clearly don't know anything about them. Mazal's talking about that part. I'm going to talk about history stuff. Okay, we're jumping back in. Check out the show notes for all of our various social media pages. You can also find them on our website, delisterersofhistory.com. That's all one word, no hyphens. And be sure to check out our new Substack for a selection of primary source documents relevant to each episode, including this one. A big thank you to all of our patrons. We couldn't do this without you. And now for an episode relevant audio drop.
The stimulating memory of that happy time of triumph, however, was marred and embittered for us by the shameful fact that when victory was won, be it remembered, chiefly by the indomitable spirit, unwavering sacrifices of our own incomparable soldiers, we turned our backs upon our associates, refused to bear any responsible part in the administration of peace or the permanent establishment of the results of the war, one that, though terrible, cost of life and treasure.